The sun is a white-hot hammer beating down on 20,000 people packed into a makeshift wooden stadium in Sydney, Australia. You can smell it before you see it, the thick, heavy scent of stale tobacco, cheap beer, and the salt spray coming off Rushcutters Bay. It's Boxing Day, 1908. Inside the ring, a man is smiling. It's not a polite smile, it's a flash of gold and defiance. His skin is the color of deep mahogany, slick with sweat that glitters like diamonds under the harsh Australian sky. His opponent, a smaller pale man named Tommy Burns, is gasping. Burns's face is a map of red welts and darkening bruises. The crowd is screaming, not for a good fight, but for a kill. They've come to see a hierarchy maintained. They've come to see the world stay the way they were told it had to be. But the man in the center of the ring, Jack Johnson, isn't following the script. He leans in close to Burns' ear. He's whispering. He's laughing. Every time Burns swings, Johnson isn't just there, he's already gone. It's like trying to punch a ghost that hits back like a sledgehammer. Then comes the 14th round. Johnson winds up. The crowd goes silent. A police officer at ringside stands up, his hand hovering over his holster. The men operating the hand-cranked motion picture cameras suddenly stop turning the handles. They don't want the world to see what happens next. Rewind Daily. I'm Marcus Webb, historian and storyteller. December 26, 1908. Today we're asking one question. What happens when you break a rule that everyone told you was a law of nature? What happens when the person you've spent a century looking down upon looks back at you and laughs? To understand the heat of that day in Sydney, we have to go back to the mud and the docks of Galveston, Texas. Imagine a young boy, the son of former slaves, working on the wharves. This is Jack Johnson's classroom. He isn't learning from books. He's learning from the way a crate shifts when it's heavy, the way a man moves when he's tired, and the way the world treats a black man who doesn't lower his eyes. In the late 1800s, there was something called the color line. It wasn't a physical wall. It was an unwritten law enforced by fists and nooses. In the world of boxing, the heavyweight championship was considered the pinnacle of human achievement. It was the ultimate proof of civilization. And for decades, the white champions refused to fight black men. They called it protecting the prestige of the title. John L. Sullivan, the great bare-knuckle champion, famously said, "I will not fight a Negro. I never have, and I never shall." But Jack Johnson? He didn't care about their prestige. He wanted the belt. He started fighting in battle royals, horrific spectacles where multiple black men were blindfolded and forced to fight each other for the amusement of white crowds. It was meant to be degrading, but Johnson used it to become a technician. He learned how to defend himself. He learned that if you can't be hit, you can't be hurt. By the time he's a grown man, he's a giant, 6 feet tall, 200 pounds of lean muscle, and a boxing style that the world had never seen. You have to understand, back then, boxing was a brawl. You stood there and you hit each other until one man fell down. It was about manliness and grit. Johnson was different. He was a scientist. He would lean back, parrying punches with his palms, catching gloves like they were baseballs. He would wait. He would provoke. And he would smile. He spent years chasing the champion, a man named Tommy Burns. Burns was a Canadian, and to be fair to him, he was a tough guy. But he didn't want to fight Johnson, not because he was a coward, but because the entire white world told him he shouldn't. They told him that if a black man won the title, the very foundation of society would crumble. So Johnson becomes a stalker. He follows Burns across the Atlantic. He follows him to London. He follows him to Paris. Every time Burns books a fight, Johnson is in the front row, shouting at him, mocking him, calling him out in the newspapers. "Why are you running, Tommy? Are you scared of a little color?" Finally, the money gets too big to ignore. An Australian promoter offers Burns $30,000, an unheard-of sum in 1908, just to step into the ring with Johnson. Burns says yes. The world holds its breath. The fight is set for Boxing Day in Sydney. Now, picture the scene in Australia. It's the height of summer. The city is buzzing. To the white population of Australia and America, this isn't a sporting event. It's a racial crusade. They call it the Great White Hope. They need Burns to win to prove that the hierarchy is real. Johnson arrives in Sydney looking like a movie star. He wears tailored suits. He drives fast cars, something a black man wasn't supposed to do. He has white women on his arm, something that in 1908 could get you killed in most of America. He's living as if the rules don't exist. And that, more than his punch, is what terrifies people. On the morning of the 26th, the crowd starts gathering at dawn. They build a stadium out of raw timber in a place called Rushcutters Bay. It's basically a giant bowl of splinters and sweat. When Johnson walks to the ring, the air is thick with slurs. The 20,000 people there aren't cheering. They are snarling. Johnson just looks at them. He adjusts his trunks. He looks at Tommy Burns, who looks nervous. Burns is 5'7". Johnson towers over him. As the referee brings them to the center of the ring, the sun is blinding. The bell rings. Round one. Most people expected Johnson to be aggressive, but he's calm. He's almost leisurely. Within 30 seconds, Johnson catches Burns with an uppercut. Burns hits the canvas. The crowd goes dead silent. You can hear the seagulls crying over the bay. Burns gets up, but he's dazed. For the next 13 rounds, it isn't a fight. It's a lecture. Johnson is doing something psychological. He's not just hitting Burns, he's holding him up. When Burns starts to slump, Johnson grabs him by the shoulders, steadies him, and then whispers in his ear, "Come on, Tommy. Show the people what you've got. Don't quit now." He's mocking the great white hope in front of 20,000 of his supporters. Every time Burns tries to clinch, Johnson laughs. The golden fillings in his teeth catch the light. By round 10, the ring is covered in Burns' blood. The champion's jaw is broken. His eyes are swollen shut. But Johnson won't end it. He wants everyone to see. He wants the cameras to capture every second of this reversal of power. In the press row, the famous novelist Jack London is sitting there, horrified. He's writing a dispatch for the New York Herald. He writes, "The fight? There was no fight. No more than between a playful tiger and a helpless fawn." London realizes that something is changing. He realizes that the myth of white supremacy is being physically dismantled in front of his eyes. We reach the 14th round. Burns is a wreck. He's stumbling, barely able to hold his hands up. Johnson is as fresh as if he just stepped out of a bath. He decides he's had enough. He prepares a massive right hand, but just as he's about to deliver the blow that would put Burns into the hospital, or worse, the police move. They don't move to help Burns. They move toward the cameras. The police inspectors signal to the camera operators, "Stop filming." In their minds, the sight of a white man being knocked unconscious by a black man is too dangerous for the public to see. It's a riot waiting to happen. It's a visual that could spark a revolution. The cameras stop. The screen goes black for the people who would watch the reels later in theaters. In the ring, Johnson lands the blow. Burns collapses. The police jump into the ring to stop the fight before the count of 10 can even be finished. They declare Johnson the winner on a technicality. It doesn't matter. Jack Johnson is the heavyweight champion of the world. The silence in the stadium is absolute. It's the sound of a worldview shattering. What happened after that day wasn't a celebration of progress. It was a backlash of fury. In America, the news of Johnson's victory sparked race riots in dozens of cities. People couldn't handle the reality of a black man being the king of the world. The search for a great white hope intensified. They eventually convinced the former undefeated champion, Jim Jeffries, to come out of retirement to wipe that smile off Johnson's face. 2 years later, Johnson fought Jeffries and destroyed him too, but the system fought back in other ways. They couldn't beat Johnson in the ring, so they went after him in the courts. They used a law called the Mann Act, a law designed to stop human trafficking, to arrest Johnson for traveling across state lines with his white girlfriend. He was sentenced to a year in prison. He had to flee the country, living as a fugitive in Europe and South America for years. He eventually came back and served his time, but he was never the same. He lost his title in 1915 in a marathon fight in Cuba. Some say he threw the fight just to get the government off his back. But think about the complexity of that moment in 1908. Johnson didn't just win a belt. He won the right to be himself in a world that demanded he be someone else. He wasn't a civil rights leader in the way we think of them today. He didn't give speeches. He didn't march. He was just a man who refused to be small. He was flamboyant. He was arrogant. He was loud. He lived his life at full volume when the world was telling him to mute himself. And that ripple effect? It's everywhere. You can see it in Muhammad Ali. Ali idolized Jack Johnson. He saw in Johnson the blueprint for the outspoken athlete. The idea that a boxer could be a poet, a provocateur, and a political force. You can see it in the way we talk about athletes today. When we argue about whether a player should shut up and dribble, we are having the exact same argument that Sidney had in 08. We are asking, does an athlete have the right to be a full human being, or are they just a vessel for our own expectations? So, why does this matter to you? Because we all have color lines in our lives, not just racial ones, but lines drawn by society, by our families, or by ourselves. Lines that say, you can go this far, but no further. You can be successful, but don't be too loud about it. You can win, but don't you dare smile. Jack Johnson's win on December 26 teaches us that the most powerful thing you can do when someone tells you that you're inferior isn't just to beat them, it's to enjoy it. It's that smile. The smile says, I am not who you think I am, and your opinion of me is none of my business. Here's the thing about that day in Sydney that most people forget. After the fight, as Johnson was leaving the stadium, the crowd was still there. They were angry, yes, but they were also curious. A small group of white Australian boys managed to get close to his carriage. They looked up at this giant of a man, this man who had just dismantled their hero. Johnson didn't sneer at them. He didn't push them away. He reached into his pocket, pulled out a handful of gold coins, and tossed them to the boys. He winked, flashed that golden-toothed smile one last time, and drove off into the Australian sunset. He didn't just take the title, he took the power. He showed them that a king isn't someone who is given a crown. A king is someone who refuses to ask for permission to wear one. What happens when you break the rules? The world might try to break you back. But for one shining moment, you get to show everyone that the rules were always just an illusion. Tomorrow, we're going to a frozen river in 1776, where a desperate man is about to make a gamble that would either create a nation or lead to a hanging. I'm Marcus Webb. This is Rewind Daily. See you tomorrow.